Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 1 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 9, delivered on September 20, 2016. The title of this lecture is Valuing Cash Flows.
Today, Valuing Cash Flows. This is the extension of what was being done last week with lump sums. And the truth of the matter is that for some of these problems, you could use the simple formula, as I did last week, to calculate the present value or the future value of a stream of cash flows. Now, technically, a cash flow could be just one amount of money. At period 0, period 1, period 2, period 3, on out, you could have at year two, let's say, $500. And that's the cash flow. Kind of a sad cash flow, but there's a cash flow for you. In general, though, when I use the term cash flow, I'm probably referring more to something that would have more than one part to it. Like in year one, $200. In year two, you'd have this $500. And then maybe in year three, $400. Now, that'd be a cash flow. A little bit better than the original one. A little terminology. This is actually kind of old school because I don't see it being called this way these days. But an annuity is a fancy word for a cash flow. An annuity, A-N-N-U-I-T-Y, an annuity. Now, they come in different flavors. The ones that are, well, they're useful for us for some things. There are level and unlevel annuities. A level annuity would refer to one that's the same amount of money every time. Did I just, okay, I'll kill that for a little bit here. A level annuity is one that occurs, it's the same amount every time. An unlevel annuity would be one that has different values, like that one would be an unlevel annuity. Interestingly, anymore, the term annuity almost, it carries the idea that it's a level annuity. But don't assume that. Okay, annuity is sort of a fancy term for a cash flow. A level annuity would be a fancy term for a cash flow that has the same amount of money in every period. Now, there are two other things that can go on here. One of two things. Now, here's a level annuity. Five periods, 5 years, or four, let's do. Okay. And here is another annuity, another level annuity. These are both level annuities, but you'll notice something. Okay, period 0, 1, 2, 3. Each of them is a four-period level annuity. But for the first one, the annuity payments begin at the beginning. And for the second one, the annuity payments begin at the end. The first one would be called an annuity due. The second one would be called an ordinary annuity. They both have $400 for four periods. Now, in terms of present value, which of these would you prefer? Which one of those would you prefer of those two level annuities? They're both $100 for four periods. Would you prefer the annuity due or the annuity or the ordinary annuity? Yes, because the money, the cash flow has slipped this way in time. Absolutely, exactly. Now, interestingly, annuity due doesn't happen as often as ordinary annuities for present values. For future values, they actually do. An annuity due is more common. Like if I just gave birth. I'm a guy. Okay, but you were just born to my wife. Okay, you were just born, and I want to prepare you for a college education. So I decided I want to put $100 into an account for you every year for 18 years. Now I would probably start that right now, and then at your 18th birthday, I'd let you pull the money out. So that one would be an annuity due. You see that? Because I'm beginning it right away, and then the last payment hangs for 1 year, accruing interest with the rest of it. So with future values, the annuity due is more common. With present values, the ordinary annuity is more common. You begin a project, and your first cash flow is coming in a year. Or you take out a car loan and your first payment is due a month from now. So ordinary annuities are more common with present values. Annuity due is more common with future values. One thing is, I teach you how to do this on a calculator. Just watch out whether it is an annuity due or an ordinary annuity and make sure that you hit the toggle for the right one. My understanding, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you took your accounting class, right? They're still having you look up numbers and tables for annuities and present values. Are they still doing it that way, or do they have you now using a calculator to do it? Is it with the tables in the backs of the books that you're doing it, or not? It is. Okay, so in other words, they're basically still in the Stone Age. And whatever their justification is, there are some things we really should do by old ways. This is not one of them. There is no reason whatsoever to use tables when we have calculators to do these things. It's just so antiquated, it almost blows my mind that there are still people using the tables. But there you go. We will use a calculator to do it. And the truth of the matter is that you can do it by hand. And there's actually a formula. You can calculate the present values of level annuities or level annuities due or whatever. You can do it with a mathematical formula. The thing, though, is that is of limited use. And there are a couple of reasons, and I'll go into those later. But for the purposes of what we're doing here, okay, now, there are different ways. You can use calculators you buy a physical calculator. Honestly, the best one out there is probably a TI-8384. It has really great financial functions in it. And I'll bring one of those in at the next class, or I'll pull up a ROM simulator, ROM, so I can get an emulator of a TI-83. But it's really an amazing way to do calculations for these kinds of problems. If you don't have that, then certainly you can buy. There's a fancy, fancy calculator out there, a financial calculator called an HP12C. It's been around that thing's been around. Mine, I've had it since the 1980s, and it's still considered sort of like a pro standard. But honestly, a lot of people use, even in business, use a TI-83 or 84 for annuity calculations, for calculation of payments on loans, for calculation of bond prices. It's just a nice calculator. However, in the absence of those, Pearson has its own version of a financial calculator. Now, on the Pearson site here, you can pull up the calculator at any time you want to do your calculations. And there's no reason why you shouldn't use it if you want to. Now, they also have an app for iPhones and Android devices. The app, there's a free version and a paid version. I think I don't know exactly what the difference is. I bought the paid version, and on my LG, it sucks. It just does not work well at all. Although I've heard most students say, oh, it's fine, it works fine. It looks just like this, and it just pops up on you. You can pull it up to like any other app on your phone. I also have it on my iPad, and the version for my iPad works fine. It's just that they just didn't do it right for LGs. I think Samsungs are doing it. It works well with Samsungs. And of course, iPhones, it works apparently quite well with them. But it looks just like this one. Okay, now, here's the thing. Whenever you're starting a calculation, you want to hit reset, okay? Reset that sucker, because it could still have information numbers in the memory banks or the virtual memory banks and all of that kind of stuff. Okay, so what's a mother to do about something like this? Well, there are a couple of different ways you can approach a problem. But if you're doing a cash flow problem, first of all, hit reset and then hit cash flow. Say, all right, we're going to do a cash flow kind of problem. Now, in this, well, let me do one that's a little more complicated. Zero, and we're going to do a level annuity, a level ordinary annuity. 5 period, and there's going to be no money at zero. There's going to be $200 at period one, $300 at periods two and three, and then $200 at period four, and then a tail as the project dies off of $100 at period five. Now, I've set this one up in a very specific way so that you can see a couple of different things going on, a couple of different tricks going on here. First things first. Okay, cash flow at zero is, there's no cash flow at zero. So you just toggle down to cash flow one, okay? And cash flow one is $200. And then you hit enter, and it asks you for the frequency of that. And in this case, there was a frequency of one consecutive. It's consecutives. Okay, so now we've got that. I always hit enter. I've never known if you have to hit enter or not. Go down, cash flow two. Well, I've got $300. Enter. Drop it down. It says, what's the frequency of that one? I look there, okay. I see that one happening twice, two. Enter. Down. Okay, now the next cash flow, and this is where it gets a little bit more confusing, 200. Enter. Down. One time, that frequency is one time. Now, down one more, and you get one more 100. Enter. Down, and that happens once. Enter. Now I'm going to need a discount rate, which I should have put up right away. Let's say it's 8% annual. Okay, so now I'm going to say, all right, I over Y, 8%, enter. Seriously? Okay, sorry about that, enter. And now I'm going to say, all right, I'd really like to find out what the present value of this is. Compute. And I'm going to use the NPV key to see if that works. Yeah. And it's $895.61. Now, interestingly, I should be able to use the PV key, the present value key, but for some reason it's not working. Something I'm doing or something about the calculator today is acting fussy. So just use the net present value key to get it. Now, the one thing you have to ask yourself, when you do one of these problems, you're either going to do it right or you're going to do it wrong. Duh. If you do it wrong, you're probably going to get an answer that thus is ridiculous. That's one of the nice things about these calculations. If you make a mistake, it's probably going to blow up in your face. The question is, does a net present value of this cash flow look like it's about $900. Well, a total value of it's $600, $800, $1,000, $1,100, but a lot of that is loaded out here. Yeah, $900 for a present value does make sense in this. It just blows up. You get some number in the millions or some number, a negative number. So you'll kind of know if you're on the right track. But for heaven's sake, watch out for accuracy, your decimal places of accuracy with answering those online questions. A story from in the next class, I'm going to show you how you calculate payments on a loan. It's a present value calculation. And there's always a couple of questions asking, well, what's your payment on this car loan? And I had one time in a written test, I had a student who got an answer for a car loan for a $20,000 car. She got an answer of like about $8,000 a month. I said, does that make any sense to you? That's got to be wrong. Does that make sense? And she said, well, I don't know. My dad pays my car payments, so how would I know? Okay, cool. It should, your payments should make sense. Present value should make sense in all of this. Okay, now, going back, madam, you are going to get money out of an account, okay? You want to say, okay, you want to buy a project that's going to draw money to you. The project is going to cost you $1,200 now, and then you're going to bring in $200 for 3 years, and then it's going to pick up to 400 for 2 more years. Now the question would be, is this project worth buying? And let's say that you will discount the cash flows at 6%. This is where that CF0, the cash flow zero, comes into play. Always remember, reset, hit your reset, and then you start flogging in, okay, we're going to do cash flow. What's the cash flow at period one? In this case, it's 1,200. Whoops. Darn. 1,200, and don't forget to say it's a negative number, enter. Down now. Notice it doesn't ask you for a frequency of your initial cash flow because it's the initial cash flow, so there won't be a frequency. So you've got $200 would be the next one, and then you drop the enter down, and that's going to happen 3 times. Enter down, and then the next one that happens is $400. Enter down twice. Enter down. Now, interest rate 6%. Enter. Compute the net present value. -$49.66. If it is even a penny negative, you say no. That's how net present value works. Even a penny negative, you say no. This is how we do project valuation. We say, all right, what is it going to cost us up front? And then what's the present value of the future expected cash inflows? And if the number that comes out, when you telescope everything back, take the negative and the present value of the positives, if it's a negative number, you just say no. That's it. That's the end of the analysis. That's as simple as we do it in finance. We're kind of like the naysayers, and it kind of irritates the hell out of people in marketing and the creatives and all of that, because we reduce whatever they have done, whatever creativity they have had, this great project idea, or the engineers, the operations management people, they need a new machine or something like that, and we break it down to this cold up or down based upon the net present value being positive or negative. That's all there is to it. In this case, it's barely, it's just barely negative, but it's negative. And therefore, that's the end of the question. And so, okay, there are two downsides to what happens. And this is where real life kind of has informed me and talking with a lot of people also. The one thing you'll find out is that if the people in the company know that it's going to go through the finance people and it's just going to be an up or down, they're going to have an incentive to inflate the positive cash flows, to be overly optimistic about what's going to happen down the line, to say, well, there are all these people are going to buy it. No, all that. There's another side that's actually larger. It has implications almost to the level of a civilization. Do you notice how very expensive projects are going to have a hard time crossing the hurdle for a yes? Another thing that is nasty is that, do you see how if the cash flows are losing value, cash flows out here, like this $400, it's not worth very much at the present value. It's not going to add too much to the total. A cash flow out here at 10 years is going to add even less to the total. It could be like $5,000, but if it's 20 years out there, it's going to have a very small present value. What this causes in modern business is a bias toward quick payoff projects. You see, the more money I have in the cash flows here in the front end, the more likely it is to cross the positive net present value hurdle. That threshold. Projects that would have great enduring value, but the value would come here almost intergenerationally, we're not going to even think about those. A story in this regard happened in the 1970s. We had come off the program, the space program. We had done a three-part approach. We did Mercury, the Mercuries, which were to get people into orbit and have them just see if we could function there. Then we had the Gemini series, where we had the people go into space and they walked outside and they did things outside of a space capsule. And then we did the Apollo, where we shot people up and first we took them around the moon to see if we could do it, and then we landed them there. Okay, great stuff. Well, how do you follow up on a trick like that? Oh, we knew what the next step was going to be. Space stations. The things that we had done in that science fiction movie 2001 A Space Odyssey in 1969. That was the next thing. The designs were put out, these giant orbiting toruses that would be rotating and create artificial gravity, manufacturing, people living there their whole lives and all that kind of stuff. That was the next phase. But the costs were staggering up front when we were looking at them in 74, 75, 76. And the payoffs wouldn't come really for 50 years when we could begin to offload people to these. We knew more about how to manufacture in space. We could get things onto the moon so that we could pull slag off the moon by magnetic throwing belts and all that kind of stuff. We knew that the positive cash flow, the huge part, was going to come way in the future. So you had insanely high costs up front. The big payoffs would be 40, 50, 60 years in the future. Didn't happen. No. Negative net present value projects by miles. And yet, if we had done that, then when we had the plans, we had the ambition, we had the forward momentum to get things done because we had done so cool with the moon landings, well, we didn't do it. And so now we've got this modular thing floating up there that really doesn't do much for us, and we're just kind of like starting again to try to do it and letting private enterprise try to bring things online as fast as possible. But there you go. That's the downside of our way, this modern Western capitalist approach to project analysis, is that it favors projects that pay off very quickly compared to projects that would have incredible benefits, but they would pay off way in the future kind of thing. So there you go. That's the downside of that. Now, see if I can do this. By the way, a caution about this, another caution that I should make. There's a problem, I think, and I have to find. Every time I go in, all the questions are randomized, even for me to look at. There's one question in I think it's the test, and you try to do it. Don't kill yourself. It's a baseball contract question, and I will give you the full credit for it after you have torn your hair out and you can't figure out how to do it. It's but some of these can get insanely complex, especially in real-world contracts, like in entertainment contracts. You can get these present values and future expected cash flows. In sports, you can get them really difficult ones. In options contracts, you can get these insanely complex chains of options and all that. So sometimes these problems can just get tediously difficult to do. And they do one in the test. It's a baseball contract. It's a real one. Figure out what the present value of this contract for this one player was. It was just got out of hand the way... the structuring of it. Okay, now. Okay. I'm going to just push some numbers in here just for a minute. Humor me. $20,000 negative. That is your initial cash flow. And we're going to do this for, how many months are in 5 years? good. I just want to make sure. Okay, so now we're going to do, I don't want to do that. 60, clear. Let me do that again. Cash flow. Okay, I'm going to do it this way. 60, I'm still screwing up here. I knew I was going to do that. Let's try this again. Cash flow, $20,000 negative. Is that $20,000? No, that's $200,000. $20,000, good. Okay, so now negative. My eyes just shot today. Okay, so enter. So now we're going to have... this calculator is acting a little strange for me right now. Let's do it this way. I'll just do it the simple way. N. 60. Always hit the N the wrong way. Enter. Okay? Okay, now. Present value. 20,000. Pause neg. Present value. Enter. Okay, so now we're going to do 8% divided by 12. So I'm going to do 8 divided by 12 equals, and I'm going to make that the I over Y. Enter. Now, compute payment. I just found out the monthly payments on a 5-year car loan for a $20,000 car with an APR, an annual percentage rate of 8%. It's a $405 a month payment for the car. Now watch how I do this again. The best way to do these is to have you watch me do them instead of trying to give you a theoretical approach. Sometimes I do that if it's important. But in a problem like this, the best way to do this is just show you. Essentially, what I have done is I said, okay, I'm going to have a monthly timeline that's going to go on for 60 months. I'm going to have $20,000 paid up front on my behalf for a car. And then I'm going to have a level annuity that has to have the same present value, a 5-year, 60 month that is, level annuity that has the same present value as what the bank is paying now for my car, $20,000. So the way you do it on one of these calculators, again, is I'm going to say, all right, it's 12 times 5 years, so that's 60 months. I always do that the wrong way. Enter. Okay, so now I'm going to do 8% divided by 12. Oh, I did that. Try that again, clear. 8% divided by 12. Why is that happening like that? Clear. Let's try it with the keyboard. 8/12. Okay, 8 divided by 12 equals... Oh, thank you. I over Y, enter. I was trying to do that smoothly so it looked really good. Okay, so now the present value, $20,000, is a negative amount. That's going out. That's what I owe. Present value, enter. And then all I have to do at this point is just say, I did put in the 60 months, didn't I? Compute the payment. And there you go. Yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So if you were to put a down payment on the car,
then you would take that out.
It would just be -$15,000.
Right, right. You got $5,000 for a car?
Sure.
Oh. No, because you'll buy a lame car. You'll buy one of those Miyevs or one of those, what's that ugly ass thing, the Soul. They should recall for ugly, but they don't. Or that Nissan Juke. Actually, I shouldn't say that. The Juke is actually kind of cool. But, okay, now it's your turn. You got $5,000. You don't want a car. What you want is your very first home. A house trailer on the south side of Decatur. Okay? I know, right? Your mom lives there. Yeah. No, seriously, she does. She does. Okay. Maybe it's my mother. Can't be my mom. She's dead. She lived in Toledo. Okay. So what we're going to do is your dream home is a double-wide trailer. And a double-wide trailer is going to cost you, I mean, this one's got everything. This one is everything. It's going to run you 80, no. You're tired of living in trailers. You're upscale. You're going to buy a house in Normal, Illinois. And that house is going to run you $160,000. And this is how much you got actually a down payment for it, but this is what you're going to have to borrow from the bank. Now, what you're going to do is you're going to take out a loan, and let's say that the loan is going to have a 5.99% APR, and it's going to be a 30-year fixed rate. Okay? You need to find out what your payments are going to be. And there's a very practical reason for this, because when you go in to ask for a loan, especially with a house, they're going to, of course, look at your credit rating, but they're also going to look at what percentage of your income this is going to take, these monthly payments. So a lot of times the threshold is 25%, 30%, something in that area. So this gives you an idea going in if you're going to meet the affordability threshold. So in a case like this, always hit reset to clear everything out. And we're going to say, all right, we're going to do 30 years with monthly payments, 30 years, 30 times 12, and I'm going to try it. Really? 30 times 12 equals, okay, 360. Okay, so that is going to be our N, 360, enter. Now, we need to do the 5.99% APR, dividing it out 12 months. So, in other words, that is your monthly as a percentage. On calculators, for God's sake, put it in as a percentage. If you're doing it by a mathematical formula, turn it into a real decimal. But in here, you just use a percentage. 5.99 divided by 12, and I'm going to say there is my interest rate right there. Enter. And I'm going to go $160,000 is the loan amount. Pause neg. And that is going to be the present value. And all you have to do now is calculate the payment. Compute the payment. Holy cats! $958 a month. So in other words, if you were making, let's say, $4,000, you would definitely, as long as your credit rating was intact, you could say, I can afford this house, and you could go in with a relative level of confidence that you would get the loan for this amount. But if I were to say, all right, suppose that I wanted to really live upscale, buy a house in Ironwood, $220,000 would be my loan amount. Pause neg, present value, enter, compute the payment. Ouch. See how you could, as long as you keep your calculation, as long as you don't hit reset, you can just push in things, replace numbers with other numbers. In this case, a house, a 30-year fixed rate, going from 160 to 220,000, popped your payments about a little more than $300 a month. The question would be, can you still meet like a 25% of disposable income threshold? And also, do you really want to wipe out an extra $300, $320, $330 a month just to live in a fancy neighborhood? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. But that's how you calculate loan payments. You can calculate any loan payment you want using this financial calculator, and it's basically just a twist on the present value stuff that I had just given you that I just showed you. Except you don't have to go through the tedium of cash flows and all of that kind of stuff. Now, last thing for today. I'm trying to find someone who looks like a real winner. Nope, not you. Madam, you are. That, you know, that just hurt like hell. And they're going to yell at me, you broke our stuff again. I know, right? Where does that go to anyway? Oh, that's where they throw the old professors when they get senile. Okay. You have just won the lottery. Okay? Now, if you know how lotteries work, you've hit big. I mean, you scored big time. You won $20 million. $20 million. Now, you got to understand, you're not going to get $20 million up front. You're not allowed. You don't get that. What they will do is, simplistically, it's different in different state lotteries. But what they're going to do is they are going to pay you $2 million for 10 years. Or $1 million, probably would be in your case, $1 million for 20 years. Okay? So they're saying you won $20 million and we're going to pay you right away, $1 million and every year $1 million. So let's see what they really won. Because you didn't win $20 million. They're lying about that. There is no $20 million in this payment. They say there is, but there is no $20 million. And they rely in every lottery for these big ticket wins, they rely on the fact that almost no one is educated in finance. And so people don't understand that there is no $20 million there. They said you won $20 million. No, you didn't. That's a lie. It's just a bald-faced lie. But fortunately, you can lie to people who don't know any better. So let's find out what that really is worth. Okay, is this an... Do you see that this is a level annuity? You see level in there. Do you see that this is actually an annuity due? This is not an ordinary annuity because your first cash flow, your first component of the cash flow happens immediately. That makes you happy. $1 million is going to shut you up. You're not going to say, well, actually, there's no $20 million. My professor, you're not going to say that. You're going to take the $1 million minus the taxes, so you'll have $5,000 left. And but anyway, let me not be harsh like that. Reset. Now. Okay, we're going to do this as a cash flow operation, okay? Cash flow one will be $1 million. Enter down. Cash flow two will be $1 million. Now, by the way, I'm doing this the dirty trick way. I'm not doing this like an annuity due. I could hit the begin button and do it that way, but I'm just going to do it straight up. Okay, so enter now down, and my frequency on this one is 19. Do you see that there's 19? I did the first one. That was the and now so there will be 19 more. Enter down. Now, we need a discount rate on this. This is a low-risk cash flow, so let's say that this is a 7.5% annual discount rate for these cash flows. So we're going to do, okay, now, we're going to do I over Y, 7.5, enter I over Y. Okay, so now let's compute the net present value. Oh, God. Look at that. Do you see a $20 million there? What I see is just barely more than half of $20 million. You done got really wrong there. You see it? That is not $20 million. A cash flow of $1 million a year for 20 years is not $20 million. It's not even close. It is a little more than half of $20 million. Because those $1 million out there, year 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, those are very small amounts of money in present value terms. So, there you go. It's just one of those little sidelights that we like to point out that knowing how present values work can inform you that this is not a good deal. This is not really. Is there anything you can do about it? Well, actually, there is. There are private brokers who will buy your 20-year million-dollar-a-year cash flow for more than $10,959,000 right off the bat. They'll offer you along the line sometimes 11, 12, 13 million. And then you sign over to them the $1 million a year cash flow. And then you get the money like 12 million right away. And that, in a case like this, would be better than what the state is offering you as the annuity due for that same $20 million win on the lottery. Neither of them is going to be $20 million, but at least this one looks a little bit nicer. That if someone offered you a private investor were to buy the cash flow from you for $12 million. In that case, in other words, buying it from you for $12 million would mean that would be a net present value to you of a little more than $1 million positive. Definitely, you would sell the project to a broker who would buy it for $12 million. That's what that is all about. Now, if you get the idea of these, that it's really not much more complicated than this. What can kill you, though, what can really murder you in these calculations is when you have cash flows that are uneven and you try to do it without a calculator. Because then all you can do, if you've got a mess, a calculation mess like this, and you've got like 400, 500, 800, oops, I didn't mean to do that, 200, 200. Basically, the only way you can do it is either with a calculator calculating the lump sum of each of them and just adding them up, or using that cash flow thing on the financial calculator, Pearson, or the TI. I'll show you how to do that on Thursday. That's the only thing you can do. There's one other last point. Oops. To make. Here's a bond. Now, when you buy an original issue bond, you're going to pay a price around $1,000. Wouldn't necessarily be $1,000. It might be a little more, a little less, but it'll be around $1,000. Now, in this case, you buy CNP 6.5%. It's a new issue. It's going to pay. It matures in 2036. Which means that for every year from the end of this coming year to the end of 2036, you will get a $65 check in the mail. Every year for the next 20 years. Well, that is just a beautiful, level, ordinary annuity. We can calculate the present value of it. But there's a wrench that goes into this engine that messes it up so that you can't do it as an ordinary annuity. At the end, you get that last $65 check, and you get your $1,000 back. So at the end, there's a kicker of $1,000, and that just blows it as an ordinary annuity. Now let's say that these cash flows, you're going to discount them every year at 7%. That's the risk level of the cash flows from this bond, 7%. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to clear it. I'm going to say, clear, reset. Okay, so we're going to do this as a cash flow. There's no money up front for it. Let's just say there's no money up front. We'll find out what a payment should be. But we're going to say, okay, now the cash flow at zero is zero. Enter. Then down. And then we're going to get $65 a year. For 19 years. And then one last payment for $1,065. Once. And the interest rate that's going to happen on this is going to be 7%. 7%. Always do that the wrong way. Now let's compute the current price you would pay for this bond. If the bond is any higher than this price, you wouldn't pay it. The current value, the present value of a level annuity of $65 for 20 years with a kicker at the end of $1,000 in the 20th year, the present value of that cash flow discounted at 7% is $947. If you had to pay any more for that, you'd say no. This bond sells at what we call a discount to par. This bond is paying less than $1,000. Why is it paying less than $1,000? Because this coupon is 6.5%, $65 a year. The market says that the coupon should be 7%. So because this bond doesn't pay as much as the market has assessed that it should, this bond will sell at a discount to par. So if you were looking at these bonds and you saw this bond pricing out at $970, you wouldn't touch it. If the bond is pricing out at $930, you'd say, yeah, that's a good buy. That's a good deal. That's how one way, and I'll show you another way you can calculate bond prices, but that's one way you can calculate a bond price. So that you can actually look at bonds and say, see whether they are about a good deal or not a good deal. Based upon your assessment, your personal decision about what the bond's yield should be. If you think the bond's yield should be 7%, that's what you put in for the I over Y. If you think the bond's yield should be more than that, watch this. Suppose that the market decided that the bond was really should pay 6.5%. Compute the net profit. Oh, well, if the market says it should pay 6.5% and the company is paying 6.5%, it sells at par. It will sell at par. The last thing to show you. Suppose that the market says, oh, this bond really shouldn't pay more than about 6.2%. Well, the market would say, oh, this bond pays 6.5%. Market doesn't think it should pay more than 6.2%. Ouch, that was a little high. This bond sells at a premium to par. I know. Will you shut up and let me finish my sentence? I really, but it's still the point's there. The point, what? 6.2. What did I do? I really screwed something up back there, didn't I? Let me try that one more time. Clear, reset. Okay, $65. Okay, wait, cash flow, nothing first. And then it pays $65. Enter, down for 19 periods. Okay, enter, down, and $1,065 at the end. Okay, enter, down once, enter, and then at 6.2%. What do I really suck at this that much? 6.2, enter. NPV. Okay. Now should be like about 1,100. No. compute. I really screwed that one up. No, it's about 1,033. In this case, because the coupon is higher than what the market wants, this bond sells at a premium to par. Par is $1,000. So in other words, and this is a lesson, trust me, I'm giving you a first pass at one of my classic questions on my first written in-class exam. When a bond's coupon is below what the market thinks it should be, the bond sells at a discount to par. When a bond's coupon is above what the market thinks it should be, the bond sells at a premium to par. It's as simple as that. When a bond, when the market thinks that a bond should pay, let me write it. No. I'm going to make it simple. When the coupon is below what the market wants, bond sells at a discount to par. When the coupon is more than what the market wants, the bond sells at a premium. At a premium to par. Now the fulcrum right here in the middle, if the coupon is exactly what the market wants, the bond sells at par. So in other words, you see this CNP bond? It was probably the coupon was very close to what the market wanted at the time of issue. I mean, that's how you do it. You try to get it as close to what the market... So 6.5% was what the market wanted. 6.5 is what CNP issued. And that way they got about $1,000 on each of the bonds that they sold. What happens to these bonds if interest rates start to go up? What happens to the price of these bonds over the next 2 years if the Fed starts to tighten the money supply and interest rates start to rise in the economy? What will happen to this bond price? It will go down. And so you will have an investment that will become worth less and less to you. Because basically, you as the investor in this bond, as a buyer of the bond, and as an original issue, you are stuck with 6.5% in an environment where new bonds would be issuing at higher interest rates. So you're going to have a bond that will be going down in price because it's not as valuable as bonds that would be issued at higher interest rates down the road. So you have to keep that in mind, that in a rising interest rate environment, you buy this bond, maybe in 3 years of another bond very similar to CNP, let's say BJT is going off at 7.2%, 2038. In 2 years, BJT and CNP were very similar companies, but because interest rates in the economy have risen over the period from 2016 to 2018, coupons are going up on bonds. So this one would be selling at par, probably about at par. This one, by that time, 6.5 compared to 7.2, the bond that people bought here will sell at a discount to par. And that's why the bond buyers, once the Fed starts hinting that interest rates are going to go up, bond buyers start getting nervous about buying these bonds because they say, look, if I buy it now, interest rates go up, this bond becomes worth less. I'm getting $65 payments. If I had waited and bought something 2 years out, I would get $72 payments. So there becomes this internalized speculation. And the Fed tries to suppress that by not talking about rising interest rates. As a matter of fact, I mentioned this last week. Just in the last couple of days, there was a lot of jitteries in the market because the Fed, there were hints Fed was slipping out. We may be raising interest rates pretty soon. We may be raising interest rates pretty soon. They were throwing out trial balloons, and the market just started peeing itself. They started, when they started selling off bonds to get out of them so that if interest rates went up, they'd have the money to buy in at the higher bond coupons. So the Fed suddenly, in the last day or so, has been saying, well, we feel that the economy is still pretty weak, so we probably won't be raising interest rates in the near future. And so everyone calmed down. Oh, so they're not going to see these kinds of things, so we'll buy in now and keep the bond markets supported. You follow how it works? It's kind of a forward psychology that the market is trying to follow. Go. You're right, and that's part of the calculation. You're saying, in other words, the present value of two-year-out money is less than the value, but the question would be, how much less? If bond prices do go up to, let's say, 7.2%, 7.5%, I would probably say that there is enough strength in that 2 years out that its present value would be worth more than the 6.5% now. But still, that would be the question. As long as I didn't think that that money out there would be worth more than money now, I'll buy now. But if I think interest rates are going to go up strongly over the next 2 years, and I do think they're going to eventually have to, but not in 2 years, I'd probably wait and buy in later.
Is there a fee to buy and sell?
Yes.
Bonds?
Yes.
So why would I keep incurring those expenses?
If you are a very large broker dealer, you can afford it because you buy in massive bulk. Someone like you, you have no reason to do this at all. I'm talking about you in 20 years when you're a very wealthy, powerful captain of industry. You have been appointed by the Trump Foundation as the heir to the entire fortune, and you have to manage it, or not. Okay, but that's the whole point, though, is that for folks like us, this is irrelevant. But remember, you're not going to work for yourself. You're going to work for someone else. And that means that it's their money and your neck on the line if you screw up. That's all I have for you. Go home.